This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
What could be the most deadly climate-driven disaster in the United States and probably most world cities? You're about to find out, and not in 2050, it's possible even this summer. News from a paper led by our guest Brian Stone Jr. just hit the New York Times, CBS News, and a lot more. Brian is a professor in the School of City and Regional Planning at the Georgia Institute of Technology, where he directs the Urban Climate Lab. From Atlanta, Georgia, Brian Stone Jr., welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much, Alex. I'm thrilled to be on the show.
Well, in 2012, you published a book, The City and the Coming Climate, so maybe this isn't big news to you, but when you say this, and I'll quote you, a widespread blackout during an intense heat wave may be the deadliest climate-related event we can imagine. Well, most of us have not imagined that. Brian, what do you picture happening?
I focused on this in the book, as you mentioned, Alex, and so I guess what's new here for me, as well as probably your listeners, is the growing potential to have a blackout during a heat wave. And so I think the first thing to observe is that heat is the deadliest threat from really the natural world to us. Of all the climate-related health impacts, heat is the greatest. It's far more deadly than hurricanes, far more deadly than tornadoes. And that's in the present period. And so for most of us, as temperatures are rising, we can take comfort in the fact that we have air conditioning, at least in the United States. But when we have a blackout, obviously, that protective air conditioning is removed, and we are exposed to what are increasingly dangerous levels of heat. And so that's what the paper was focused on.
When you talk about mass deaths, some might accuse you of exaggerating, but then we remember at least 14,000 people died in their homes in France in the European heat wave of 2003, and at least 700 people a day died in Moscow in their heat wave in 2010. So even without power failures, heat alone can be a mass casualty event, don't you think?
Yeah, these are really big numbers that you're mentioning. And so again, you know, hurricanes capture the imagination. They are absolutely increasing over time, at least the most intense hurricanes, and we do see a death toll from these events, but it does not match the more silent threat of a heat wave. And so, you know, you referenced some significant events, but year over year, right now in the United States, we're experiencing about 12,000 deaths a year from extreme heat. So these are big numbers.
It's amazing, but I do recall a couple of our guests suggested heat deaths had actually gone down in the United States since cities learned to take them seriously and take action. First of all, is that true? And second, have we become complacent?
I don't think it's true. There's always a debate over the numbers of heat-related deaths because it's hard to measure directly. To diagnose hypothermia or heat stroke, you need to have a core body temperature that's about 106, 170 degrees. And so usually by the time a victim arrives at the hospital, they have cooled down. It's a rather morbid topic. But it is difficult to directly code a heat death. But we can look statistically at the number of deaths in the United States day over day, particularly in the summer, and see how it correlates with temperature. And we find that it's a pretty strong correlation. And so whether you're dying directly of heat or whether the heat is an underlying condition and you have cardiovascular disease, that's a heat-related death, and those numbers appear to be increasing pretty consistently over time.
I think we all presume that cooling centers can take in people without AC. What is the problem with that?
Well, there are two major problems. One, we don't have anywhere near enough cooling centers. And so, again, I think this is part of the larger kind of cultural orientation to heat that perceives it as less threatening than it is. And so we tend not to have a large number of cooling centers. In my own city of Atlanta, we have about five formally designated cooling centers. These tend to be community centers, you know, basketball courts, and they're not very large. And so that represents a challenge if we get an unprecedented heat wave, and in particular if we have a blackout, because none of the three cities we looked at in the study, which was Atlanta, Detroit, and Phoenix, have required backup power generation. And so if you do have a blackout with a heat wave, even having a large number of cooling centers, and I don't think any U.S. city has a sufficiently large number, that's not going to be protective of the population if there is not backup power.
That's really shocking that they don't have backup power. I just don't understand that. Meanwhile, most climate dialogue is about the global average temperatures, but several EcoShock guests warned us that regions get much hotter than a global average, and then cities get much hotter than that. What predictions are there out there about urban heat and that you're working with?
Well, very few. My research group, the Urban Climate Lab at Georgia Tech in Atlanta, has been focused on this for a long time, and we remain one of the few groups that's trying to measure how rapidly cities, in particular large cities, are warming year over year. And we find that in the United States, the largest cities tend to be warming at a rate that is more than double that of the planet. And so if you're planning on a rate of warming that's consistent with the planetary average, you are largely underestimating how rapidly your city is heating up.
We're talking so far about the outside heat measurements. What is going on inside people's homes where most folks are trying to shelter during the heat wave?
That is the condition about which we know the least, Alex, and that was the core focus of our study. And so there are many studies that have tried to forecast moving forward how temperatures will rise outside. It's difficult then to understand how temperatures will be impacted on the inside of our homes. And so for this study, we looked at a historical heat wave, and so this is not a future heat wave, but one of historical intensity in these three cities. And then we used a building energy model to simulate what the temperatures would be inside the homes with a functional grid, and then that assumes that those who normally have air conditioning would have the air conditioning running, and then with a non-functioning electrical grid. And so how high would temperatures get inside during a heat wave without power? And what we find is that in some housing types, it would be hotter inside than outside. And this is particularly alarming in a city like Phoenix, where you have heat wave temperatures that are greater than 110 degrees Fahrenheit. So we're seeing temperatures inside the homes reaching more than 110 degrees. And that's obviously a very hazardous condition.
Why are poorer people already at higher risk during a heat wave, whether the power stays on or off?
Yeah, great question. And there are a number of reasons. One of those reasons is that there is less access to air conditioning. And so we find that lower income households in our three cities are more than 20% less likely to have air conditioning. And so in a city like Phoenix, most people have air conditioning, but there's a sizable population that just won't use the air conditioning because it's too expensive. And so lower income households fewer have air conditioning. Fewer use it if they have it, and so that is placing them at a particular risk. And then we also see other vulnerabilities associated with just poor baseline health in lower-income communities and communities of color. And so this is a particular vulnerability that is part of really a climate justice issue, is that there are populations that are more at risk even today than others, and it's typically driven by income and by race.
Well, and yeah, you can see why some people might be afraid to turn it on when you look at what happened to the people in Texas who had a variable rate. They were paying thousands of dollars for a couple of days' worth of electricity during that winter storm in February. I want to get to the international view, though, here. The upcoming COP climate talks in Scotland, they'll deal with global average temperature safety guardrails, as they see it, of about 1.5 degrees C or 2 degrees C of warming. But meanwhile, I spoke with Chinese scientist Lei Zhao, and he told us world cities are projected to go up to 4 degrees C hotter and beyond. Brian, would you talk to us about the urban heat island effect, which you've studied for years?
So there are four elements of the design and operation of cities that make them hotter. Cities are just hotter environments. This is absent the global greenhouse effect, although the global greenhouse effect is amplifying this. And so in cities, we know we remove a lot of the natural vegetation. And so in my part of the world, in the eastern United States, that tends to be forest cover. And so if you're cutting down trees in a region in Georgia or you're doing it in the Brazilian Amazon, you're raising temperatures. You're losing the shading that we've all experienced and that cooling effect. But even more importantly, evapotranspiration. And this is basically the release of water vapor to cool down the air, and trees do that very effectively. And so just removing the natural vegetation, whether it's trees or grass, whatever it is, will likely raise temperatures. And then in cities, we double down on that result by bringing in high heat capacity materials. And so asphalt and concrete and roof shingling, these are materials that absorb heat and store it very well. And so that raises temperatures even further. And then we have a lot of waste heat that's emitted in cities. And so if you do run your air conditioning, you are just mechanically removing heat from in the building and venting it outside. And that heat aggregates across a lot of buildings. Tailpipes are releasing a lot of heat too. And so that elevates temperatures. And then lastly, the three-dimensional morphology is what we call it as planners, the three-dimensional shape of cities. You can think about downtown street canyons with high buildings and vertical surfaces. That can trap outgoing heat and further raise temperature. So the combination of these four elements of cities can raise temperatures on a typical afternoon in the summer by, 5 to 15 degrees Fahrenheit. And so that's quite some additional warming that you see in cities that you don't see in rural areas.
It's pretty shocking. I've seen photos of streets in Mumbai where, it's just a wall of air conditioners in every window. And you walk down those alleyways and it's like going through a hairdryer or something. Meanwhile, I want to switch to something that's in your paper that really interested me. Climate scientists worry about so-called compound events. An example you cite in your paper could be wildfires breaking out during a drought, and that's really possible this year in the U.S. Southwest. But your study goes further, adding non-climatic stressors. Talk to us about that, Brian, please.
Yeah, I think we're all familiar with two weather-related events happening at the same time. And so you mentioned a wildfire during a heat wave or a heat wave in a drought. These weather events are related, and so to see more than one extreme event happening at the same time is not that unexpected or unusual. But, of course, these events also stress our infrastructure. And so, the human impacts of these extreme natural events are mediated by the infrastructure of the city, which includes the electrical grid, includes our transportation systems, and includes our air conditioning systems. And so if we have a breakdown in critical infrastructure during an extreme event, that is a particular type of compound event that is likely to be more hazardous and deadly than just a combination of two natural events. And so even the pandemic that remains unfolding right now can be conceived as a compound event in that it is, it's stressing climate change and the pandemic are stressing the impact on communities when we have, for example, a heat wave or a hurricane and we have to use shelters and we have more transmission. So we really needed to have some new language about compound events that's not just focused on weather events.
And how do you define an electricity blackout, and are they increasing in the United States?
That's a great question, and our study was not initially focused on trying to measure the frequency of blackout events, but that ended up being a major finding. And so what we have seen is that since 2015 in the United States, the number of major blackout events, and so those are events that impact more than 50,000 customers, has more than doubled. So just in 6 years, we've seen major blackout events in the United States have more than doubled. And so we were asking that question because we simply wanted to simulate a blackout event. And so we said, well, how long would a blackout event last if it impacted more than 1 million customers, or a large city blackout? And we've had these events in the last 5 years. And so it turns out that the average number of hours of a major blackout event impacting 1 million customers is about 5 days. So that's a very long time to not have your power. And so in trying to determine what is a reasonable duration of a blackout to simulate, we also discovered that blackouts are increasing very rapidly. And this has not really been covered in the media, which is somewhat surprising to me, but the information is rather hard to get your hands on.
So your latest paper, published in Environmental Science and Technology, April 30th, is titled Compound Climate and Infrastructure Events, How Electrical Grid Failures Alters Heat Wave Risk. What brought you and your team to look into this, Brian?
Well, as I mentioned, we've been focused on how rapidly cities are warming for a long time. And so based on finding how much heat is amplified in cities and how rapidly it is increasing, we've been partnering specifically or directly with city governments to develop adaptations. How can cities manage this rising threat to their population? And so during the course of that work and those partnerships with cities, we've come to recognize that cities are not well positioned to manage extreme heat events. They have very few cooling centers. The cooling centers don't have backup generation. And so that's what led us to raise the question, well, what would be the health impacts, the potential health impacts of a heat wave if it occurred at the same time as a blackout? And then the other thing I should note is that not only are blackouts increasing, they are most rapidly increasing in the summer months. And so that greater demand on the electrical grid because of all the air conditioning use is leading itself to more blackouts. So this is really a growing threat during the summer months.
Well, the energy balance in the United States has really tipped. It used to be the big energy was all used in the winter because it was, you know, you had to heat your homes. But now it seems with milder winters and really hot summers, it's going the other way.
It's true. And it's also, I mean, you mentioned the event we saw earlier this year in Texas. It's also important to mention that, you know, air conditioning is pretty much exclusively driven by electricity. There are a wider range of fuel sources for heating your home, including just burning wood. You don't really have that option when the power goes out in the summer. And so we are more vulnerable in general to energy shocks in the summer during extreme weather because our singular mode of cooling is lost.
Tell us what you found for the three cities you chose for this study.
So we focused on these three cities, Atlanta, Georgia, Detroit, Michigan, and Phoenix, Arizona, because they represent a diversity of climate types. You know, it ranges from a higher latitude city in Detroit to a dry and hot city in the southwest to a wet and hot city in the southeast. And so we wanted to capture that diversity. And then we also have a diversity of housing types. And so we're very much focused on simulating heat exposures, temperatures inside everyone's home. And so we're interested in single-story, single-family houses and multi-story houses and apartment buildings. So we wanted to capture that diversity across these three cities. And so looking at the range of impacts, and specifically what we do is we just measure what the heat index value is. And so a heat index is a combination of the temperature and the humidity inside people's homes. We're all used to seeing the weather report forecast, maybe the heat index for the next day, but that's the ambient outside temperature. So we're focused on the inside temperatures. And we find that if you were to have a blackout during a heat wave that lasted 5 days, that the number of residents that would be exposed to dangerous levels of indoor temperatures and humidity, and these are levels that would be associated with either heat exhaustion or heat stroke, and heat stroke is a deadly episode, then we found that the number of residents exposed would range from about 70% in Atlanta and Detroit up to 100% in Phoenix. And so were this to occur, a heat wave of historical intensity in Phoenix with a blackout of historical duration, everyone in Phoenix would be at risk of heat illness, either heat exhaustion or heat stroke, and about 70% would confront that risk in Atlanta and Detroit. So these are large numbers for that level of risk.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Georgia Tech professor Brian Stone, Jr. We're talking about a possible mass casualty scenario if the electrical grid goes down during a major heat wave. So beyond a doubt, the world is much hotter than it was in 1950. Heat waves come more often and last longer. So it makes sense sooner or later a blackout will happen during a heat wave. But does the heat make a grid failure more likely, Brian?
Yes, it absolutely does. And so the heat is placing pressure on the grid in terms of demand. And so as temperatures go up, we use our air conditioners more. Those who may not always use their air conditioner will run it full time or be more likely to. And so there's greater demand. But we also see that physically the infrastructure can be stressed as well. And so the most extensive North American blackout was in 2003, where more than 50 million lost their power in both the northeastern U.S. and in Canada. And that resulted from some transmission power lines, high voltage power lines, physically sagging during a heat wave. And so that there was so much heat energy in those power lines that they physically sagged and came in contact with some trees that had not been cleared from the transmission corridor. And that basically shorted out a large fraction of the North American grid. And so heat can absolutely stress our electrical grid in multiple ways.
Well, maybe we should add this. Climate change denial is often stronger in places where the risk of high heat and grid failure are greatest. I'm thinking like in Texas and Arizona. And maybe that leads to inaction and lack of public planning. What do you think?
It's an interesting observation, Alex, that we see more climate denialism in places that confront higher heat risk. I actually haven't considered that or seen a study of that in the past, but typically, in a generic way in the U.S., I think that likely is true, although we do find denialism all over the country. But in the case of Texas, we have a textbook example of how climate vulnerability is enhanced when the government is out of step with climate science. Texas is the single state in the United States that has its own division of the national electrical grid. And so, the Northeast has one division of the grid, the Southeast has a division of the grid, and what this means is that all the electrical utilities are interacting and can share electricity across their borders. That's harder to do in Texas because Texas did not want to comply with federal regulations, which are designed to ensure that you have the generating capacity and resilience to manage extreme weather. And so, Texas is confronting greater likelihoods of blackouts because they have opted out of the federal regulatory system. And that certainly seems to be associated with, to some degree, climate denialism that we see in the state government in Texas.
Are some homes better than others when it comes to surviving a heat wave with no electricity?
Yeah, this was somewhat of a surprising result, at least in my mind, from our study. I mentioned that we looked at different housing types from single-story homes to multi-story homes to apartment buildings. And we actually found that apartment buildings experienced the lowest rise in temperatures during a concurrent heat wave and blackout. And that is because you simply have shared walls. So you have fewer walls that are exposed to direct sunlight in an apartment building. You also have a greater core of air, greater air volume on the interior of that building. And so it just takes more time for the air to circulate throughout an entire apartment building and to distribute that heat than it does in a smaller home. And so a single-story, single-family house, we found to have the highest indoor heat exposures. We also find that that's the housing type across these three cities that is more likely to be occupied by lower-income households. So it's a combination of the design of the structure. They tend to be older structures with poor insulation. And then they also tend to be, in many instances, lower-income families.
Well, thinking about this, it's so shocking. We think, well, what can we do? And you've talked about, changing roof colors, perhaps white, and even road colors, planting more trees. From what you've heard so far, do you think President Joe Biden's infrastructure bill will help strengthen the grid and maybe reduce the risk of this mass casualty event?
I think it will. Now, this remains to be seen in what form it gets passed, if it gets passed at all. But there's $100 billion there, I believe that's the right number, that is focused on increasing grid resilience. And so this is a critical thing that is needed because as heat is increasing, as our demand for electricity is increasing, our national investments in the grid have not kept pace, like all of our infrastructure, really. So that is really an important component of this bill and one that I hope will find its way to finalized legislation. But the other aspect of this you mentioned, we refer to strategies cities can pursue to lower temperatures, basically to cool themselves down. We call that urban heat management. And so planting trees, having more reflective surfaces, these are strategies that work against the urban heat island effect. And we find that these can be very powerful strategies to cool down a city. You can really measurably cool down a heat island by increasing green cover and cool materials over time. To my knowledge, there's nothing in the infrastructure bill that's focused specifically on that. And these are strategies that cities tend to be pursuing, if they are at all, on their own without federal support. But there is a great need for more funding to be focused on climate adaptation, and urban heat management for cities is a key part of that adaptation.
A couple of Australian cities lost power during extremely high heat events, and I'm wondering, do you think your study on extreme heat risks during a power blackout applies to other cities in the world?
Yeah, I do. One of the limitations of our study was that we could only focus on three cities. And the reason we did that is because we are trying to simulate temperature in every single home, every single residential structure in three cities. And so that, you know, it's almost a million structures. And every one of those has its own, basically its own climate model that is running to understand how the climate would change under those conditions. And so we're really limited in terms of computing capacity, how many cities we can look at. But we did focus on very standard building types. And so, you know, we see single-story, multi-story homes, apartment buildings in all cities in all parts of the world. So, you know, in terms of their engineering, they are not so dramatically different that our results would, we'd find our results would vary greatly across these cities. And then we also had a diversity of climate zones. And so we find between 68-70% to 100% of all residents would confront a risk of heat illness or death during a combined blackout and heat wave. And I think that would be true, that range would be true for most large cities across the world.
The hot season is coming in the Northern Hemisphere, and this year may be among the hottest, as all the recent years have been record years. Can we avoid this terrible outcome, Brian, or do you think a mass heat death will have to happen before America really reacts?
Well, I don't want to be overly cynical. I do see that there has been some considered and continued attention on what happened in Texas this winter with a blackout during an extreme winter event. We also saw this in California. In the last couple years, a different kind of compound event, which is wildfires that are triggering blackouts and also concurrent with heat waves. And so we had people, you know, in California last summer without power confronting the risk of a wildfire and also during a heat wave. You know, this is kind of a triple threat in that case. And so we are seeing really extreme climate conditions. This will be a reality of our lives moving forward, no matter what we do. And at the same time, that's stressing our infrastructure. And so we should all be prepared for a breakdown in critical infrastructure at the moment it is most needed. And so for some folks who have means, that will mean you might have some backup electrical generation yourself. Cities can quickly pivot and provide backup electrical generation for their cooling centers. They can expand their cooling centers. It does take time to improve the resilience of the grid. It does take time to adapt strategies that will cool down cities or slow the rate of their warming. But providing backup power generation for some large facilities for your critical population during such a compound event is something we can do relatively quickly. And so I hope to see some of these actions happening in the coming years.
I'm also a fan of distributed power. I mean, if people have a decent solar installation on their roof and have the battery power to back it up, they will be able to run their own air conditioners and there will be less stress on great big regional things. I mean, coal plants, nuclear power plants, even gas turbines often have to shut down during extreme heat when we need them the most. So maybe our shift in energy production units will help us too.
You're absolutely right, Axel. I don't think we tout this benefit of renewables enough, is that having a distributed rather than a centralized electrical generation system, or what you're getting is actually multiple systems, provides greater resilience. And so during a storm, for example, something that might bring down a single generating unit may not bring down multiple generating units from, you know, whether it's wind turbines or solar panels, and the ability to support the grid when these traditional fossil-based sources of power production go down. And so I think this is a really important dimension of renewable energy that's not simply related to the fact that they are carbon neutral or mostly carbon neutral, but that they themselves enhance the resilience of the grid and enable us to hopefully have more capacity to weather extreme events.
As we wrap up, what are you and the Urban Climate Lab working on next?
We are most focused on partnering directly with cities to help them adapt. This is our central work, and we're focused on helping cities develop heat management plans. I don't know that there's really a single city in the United States that has a comprehensive heat management plan. And again, heat is the greatest climate-related threat to health moving forward, really across the world. And so cities need to be prepared. There are many things cities can do on their own to reduce the heat risk of their residents. And so we're partnering directly with cities to help develop those plans and really assess what the heat risk is to their neighborhoods and their residents.
We have been speaking with Brian Stone, Jr., professor at Georgia Tech and director of the Urban Climate Lab. Find links to his new paper in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Brian, thank you for developing this story, difficult as it is to hear.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you, Alex, and your listeners. Thanks so much.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.